Once again, I've had a request for this evening's talk. It was actually a request which someone gave me in Singapore about a month ago, but I forgot it. So they sent another email reminding me. And the topic of the talk this evening is, what is a Buddhist perspective concerning animal abuse in our society? The Buddhist perspective on animal abuse. I certainly know the Buddhist perspective on monk abuse. Oh, you make me work so hard. But I enjoy it. But Buddhism does have something to say about just the way we treat the animals of our society, the other living beings of our society. This is not just a modern thing in Buddhism, because from the very start, the compassion of Buddhism from the start went to all sentient beings, not just my own tribe, not just my own gender, not just my own religion, but to all human beings, and more than that, to all other sentient beings, all beings, certainly including animals in that. And there is a good reason for that. There's a fundamental reason why our compassion goes even to the animal realm. And that is a twofold reason. One is that Buddhism has recognized from the start there's not that much difference between the animal realm and human beings. There's something which we have in common, which is the human mind. Or not the human mind, just the mind. And number two, because we have that common part we call a mind, that's why that human beings can get reborn as animals. Animals can get reborn as human beings. There is that coming and going between those two realms and between other realms as well. And recognizing that, you have to be kind and compassionate to the animals. Otherwise, that animal, that might be your father. That might be your mum, your dear sister, or whatever else it is who just passed away. So you don't want to mistreat them. But more importantly than the fact that rebirth happens from one to the other, there's many cases of that. More important than that is the understanding, the realization there is something common between the animal realm and the human realm. I think in many other countries, many other sort of philosophies or religions, we make this big distinction between the human beings and the animals, as if we're so superior and so different than the animals. And we make ourselves special. And that specialness is always like conceit. Just in history, you know, we had certain races were supposed to be special and superior than other races. And unfortunately, we got rid of most of that racism. But then recently, we've started getting rid of genderism, where, you know, men were supposed to be so superior than women. We're trying to address that issue now and make it see through the fallacy of that idea. But then we've also got sexual preferenceism, as if heterosexuals are much better and superior than homosexuals. These are all things which we should get rid of as soon as possible, because they create so much suffering and hurt in our society. It's always thinking that, you know, we're superior and those other group, those people, are somehow inferior to us. We've put a lot of energy and effort and understanding in that equality towards those, you know, sexual preferences, to the genders, to races. But the one thing we haven't really started on yet in our modern society is what is called speciesism. As if we think that our human being is so superior, so far advanced on the animal realm, that we can do whatever we like to them, that they don't really count. They're not the same as us. I remember my dear old grandmother. You know, she was a bit of a racist, you know, an English person, lived in London most of her life. When the first Asians, you know, came to live in her street, I remember as a kid, it's one of my memories, you know, turning around to me and say, "You know, they're not the same as us. They eat cat food." That's what my granny said. Poor dear. Of course, I didn't believe her. But you can actually see where that was coming from. It was a sense of, they are different than I am, therefore we don't have to treat them the same way. And I always watch that with myself, just the way that we separate ourselves. You know, that, you know, whether it's those people of the different religion, they're not the same as us, you know. And it's as if like we're somehow superior. That superiority, that conceit, that making differences where those differences shouldn't be made, is where we get the problem of not looking after, exploitation, even like hurting and abuse. And so here this evening we're going to look at the animal realm. Are they so different? Do they really deserve just the way that they're treated? Or are they much closer to human beings than we really would admit? And of course, as far as Buddhism was concerned, they are so close to human beings, they should be given pretty much the same sorts of rights, especially the right to life. We're talking here about a declaration of animal rights, not just human rights, but the rights of all beings, extending the very concept of human rights to those beings who are presently excluded. Just look at it, even through science. I remember reading about, I think the fellow was called Linnaeus. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but this was a scientist who was responsible for the very idea of species, where he made some sort of template, some sort of means of ordering all the different beings which existed in nature, to actually to group them together according to their characteristics. And if the characteristics were close enough, he called them, that was a species. And he used that criteria, as a good scientist should do, without any bias, to all the different beings in nature, until he came across these three beings, the chimpanzees, the gorillas, and the human beings. According to his criteria, according to all the science and reason and logic, he came to the conclusion that this was one and the same species. When it comes to species, human beings, gorillas, chimpanzees are one and the same. But he was in a Western society, a society which was basically Christian, and he realized that his whole work would not be accepted if he lumped human beings along with gorillas and chimpanzees. And because of that, for once, he dropped his science and did what was politically correct at the time, by splitting off human beings as a separate species, Homo sapiens, and separating those other two primates as a different species. The point was that science was telling him, reason was pointing out, there is no difference as far as species is concerned. That's why that many of us, when we have children, call them little monkeys. Why there are some people standing at the doors of the nightclubs in Northbridge who look like gorillas. We are the same species. Now you see that it's making a connection there, a bridge between the human beings and other animals. And once you start making it with one group of animals, it becomes very easy to make it with other animals. It was fascinating actually to see that modern research has been able to allow animals to talk. The two which I remember, because I saw documentaries of these two, one was, say, a gorilla in, I think, the zoo in New York called Coco, who was taught sign language. Just as we have sign language for those people who cannot speak, and the ability to teach young children who are born disabled, to teach them to speak with sign language, that ability to teach has been so well refined that they applied the same techniques to a gorilla to see what would happen. And this gorilla learnt it very well and could communicate with its owners, with the psychologists, in very clear sign language. And what really shocked the psychologists who were doing this little experiment was to see Coco, when he thought he was by himself, talking to himself. Not communicating with anyone else, but communicating with himself. Which was actually showing there was a verbal intelligence there with that animal, which was completely unexpected. He was behaving like a human being. The other was a parrot, a grey African parrot called Alex. I saw this in an article, and when I heard that there was going to be a documentary about Alex the parrot on the TV, I got someone to videotape it for me, and I saw the video. And it's a sort of video which sends like the hairs on the back of your head, if you had any as a monk, it would send them sort of up because it was very, very spooky. Because there they taught Alex the parrot. You know that African, grey African parrots can actually, they can actually vocalize words. You've probably seen that in the zoo. Things like minor birds and parrots and cockatoos. Some of them actually can say words which sound exactly like human words. They can vocalize. But this particular grey African parrot, they didn't just teach him like one or two words. They taught this parrot a whole vocabulary. And then they wanted to see whether this parrot could use that vocabulary intelligently. And the parrot could recognize things, and could actually even work out sort of new words. And I saw in this documentary this parrot talking to these psychologists, having a conversation. This wasn't sort of, you know, special effects done by, you know, DreamWorks in sort of in the US. This was like a real parrot talking. It was only a limited conversation. I don't think we can invite that parrot to Dhammaloka Buddhist Center to give an hour-long talk on Buddhism. But nevertheless, it could give a reasonably intelligent conversation. And what really convinced me that this was an intelligent parrot was when it threw a small tantrum. It was on its little perch and it sort of said, "I'm bored," and stalked off. Now, those are cases where you see there is something which is intelligence, which we can recognize as the same trait as human beings. When we can recognize those same traits, those intelligence, even like speech, it means that that distinction between human beings and animals is broken. We see what we have in common. In the same way, eventually, my granny, because I think a Pakistani couple took over the corner shop, she became friendly with them. And she realized, hey, they are the same as us. Hey, animals are the same as us. Even though cats do eat cat food, they are the same as us. They deserve the same rights, the same respects, and not abuse. In the same way that we had made slaves, or rather the Western world, made slave of Africans. Now we look back upon that as one of our great abuses. We shouldn't have done that. Now we make slaves of animals. In future times we'll realize we shouldn't have done that. Animals have emotions. Animals have intelligence. For those of you who don't remember that story, if we have a cat at our monastery, we call it Kit Kat. We're not very imaginative as monks. Now that cat was born in a monastery in Serpentine. It was born as a little kitten in a log. It was a feral cat's daughter. And as soon as it was born, it was such a friendly cat, and the monks need a bit of emotional support with a little cat around. And so it became part of our community very quickly. But unfortunately, as many of you know, cats in the Australian forest, in the bush, are not in the right place, because cats eat birds. They're a danger to the local wildlife. So even though we decided to actually, what we call in our monastery, to monasticize our female cat, so it didn't have kittens, that you all know what that means, to monasticize it. And that was the only time it left the monastery, just to go to the vet in Byford. But anyone who knows that part of town, Byford is not yet in the metropolitan area. The southern tip of Perth ends at Armidale, and Byford's about 10 kilometres south of there. So we took it to be monasticised. That's the only time it left the monastery. But after a year or two, that cat was killing too many birds. It was in the wrong place, so we decided the only thing to do was actually to give it to someone in town to look after. Cats in the bush were in the wrong place. So there's one of our members who lived in Watermans, and you all know where Watermans is, about maybe 8 or 10 kilometres to the northwest of here, by the ocean. It was a very sad day when I had to catch Kit Kat, the cat, because I like that cat, and put it in a bag, and put that bag in this lady's car, in the back seat, where your feet go, so there's no way it can look out the window. And she drove it all the way from Serpentine to Watermans. She took the bag into her house and let the cat out in the house and kept it in her house for 3 days. After 3 days, when she thought the cat was used to its new surroundings, she let it go out in the garden for the first time. That cat made a run for the gate. The woman ran after it. The cat was too fast. It was a Saturday, and I was on duty here at Noramara. She rang me right afterwards. "I'm terribly sorry. The cat has escaped." I thought that that cat, because it was a clever cat, would find its way back to Serpentine. It never did find its way back to Serpentine. It found its way back to Noramara. It had never been in the metropolitan area ever before. It made its way from Watermans to the front wooden door of that building over there in 2 hours. I heard a mewing at the door about 2:30. I was getting ready for the afternoon meditation. I opened the door and I couldn't believe that was Kit Kat. That cat had found me in the whole of Perth, the only sort of person it knew in this whole big city. It made it from Watermans to Noramara in 2 hours across the freeway. Its poor little paws were sort of red hot. It was a hot day in the summertime. How can a cat find its way to Noramara? Even many of you get lost trying to find a place. And you've got the UBD, you've got mobile phones, you've got the RAC to come and help you. That cat was not a member of the RAC. It couldn't use a phone book. It couldn't look in a UBD. It found its place in 2 hours. 8 kilometre run. And of course, as soon as it did that, we realised that that cat, we can't sort of get rid of it. It belongs. So it's, you know, still in our monastery at Serpentine. Now that is intelligence. It's not an I washed my robe that weekend. It couldn't smell. It can't smell a monk from 8 kilometres away. How on earth can that happen? And many of you had other stories where that happens. There is great intelligence in those animals. And when you realise that, you realise there's not that much difference between us. Even like animals talking. I was always fascinated, not just with Buddhism, but you know, with some of the mystic tradition of Christianity. And of course, you all know of a person called St. Francis of Assisi. I was always, of all of the monks in Christianity, that was the one which was closest to being a Buddhist monk. Just the way that he lived, would always beg for the food, would never have any money, would live out in nature. Very similar to a Buddhist monk. And what was even more similar was this person was reputed in history to be able to talk with animals. The animals were able to talk with him. And of course, when I first read that, I thought, that's just myths, just making up stories, just saying something to inspire people to be Christians. But then I read of another story concerning St. Francis. In those days in Europe, I think it was the 13th century, if I'm not mistaken, there were huge forests in Europe. They never had tigers like in the Asian forests. They had wolves. And those wolves were just as dangerous. They would actually kill people and certainly they would eat children. And as he walked into one of these walled towns in Europe, I think somewhere in Italy or Germany, the people there were actually quite surprised he'd made it, because there was this huge wolf in the neighborhood who'd already killed many children. And they said, "You're very lucky to have made it into this town. We've lost so many. We tried to hunt that wolf. We haven't been able to find it yet." And according to the story, that St. Francis, out of compassion for animals, said, "Well, where is it? I'll go and try and solve the problem." And so he went out again looking for the wolf. According to the story, he found that wolf and asked the wolf, "Why are you eating so many children?" And the wolf replied, according to the tale, "Because I'm hungry. It's been a very hard year in the forest. There's nothing to eat. So I have to eat the children, because that's all there is." St. Francis said, "Well, if I can get you other food, will you stop eating children?" "Of course," said the wolf. And according to the story, St. Francis led the wolf into the town. And it was they saw this huge wolf following meekly behind this little monk. And they said, from that time on, the town's people made sure that wolf had something to eat and became almost like a pet of the town. So such was the story, which, you know, I thought when I first read it, they'd made up. But about 60 years ago, in that very town, in the local cathedral, they were doing some renovations. Even if you go into the cathedrals in Perth, you see in many of the walls there, there's little plaques saying who died, and their ashes are actually behind those plaques. The same in our monastery in Serpentine, on our front wall, we put the ashes of the dead in that wall and put a plaque on the outside. It's common to bury the ashes of dead people in churches or monasteries. The reason why we do it in Serpentine is because eventually we want to put a wall all the way around and have the ashes all the way around the monastery, so we're protected by the ghosts of the departed, so no one will dare to come in because we've got ghosts all around. But anyway, they had this, they were doing renovations, and they opened one of these niches, and in the niche was not the bones of a human being, but it was the bones of a huge wolf. Evidence, hard evidence, that maybe that story was true. And I think it is true. You can talk to animals, and animals can talk to you if you are sensitive enough. One of our old caretakers, those of you who've been here long enough, remember Jasper? When he was staying here, he'd work at our monastery doing some just gardening work. And he would come every morning and go back again, come back for here to Nolamara. He told me one day at the corner of the road, the junction between the Southwest Highway and Kingsbury Drive, he went up there one morning, he saw there was a parrot on the ground lying dead. He'd been hit by a car. But what took his attention was on the branch of a tree, looking down, was another parrot. It was looking down at the parrot lying dead on the ground. When he left work at our monastery that afternoon, the dead parrot was still down there, and so was the parrot on the tree. No parrots mate for life. He thought maybe those parrots were partners, husband and wife. One of them being killed, the other was up on the tree looking down. He was surprised the following morning. He expected to see the parrot on the ground, but he never expected to see the parrot on the tree, hadn't moved, was still looking down. That afternoon, they were still there. He said for 3 days, that parrot up on the tree didn't move. What does that sound like to you? To me, it sounds like grief. A parrot was grieving for his partner, who had been killed. Animals cry. I've seen animals cry. One of the great stories which I have about the compassion to animals occurred reincarnate prison farm. Many of you know that before I became abbot, I used to go there to teach meditation regularly. And this story was told to me by one of the prisoners. When I turned up at the session, there was somebody waiting for me, this big Irish prisoner. It was strange. I must have been, well, just my character, I suppose. But when I saw this huge guy with big bushy hair and a beard and scars all over him, straight away I said, "Sir, you've come to the wrong place. This is meditation." I thought, you don't expect to see a guy like that in my meditation group. But that was just my conceit. I was wrong. Because he said, "Yeah, I'm here for the meditation." But first of all, he wanted to tell me something which had happened a few days before, which had changed his whole life. He told me that, for those of you who know Carnot Prison Farm, it's a prison farm. It's supposed to be for prisoners who are about to be released at the end of their sentence or with short sentences. And they have a farm there because they want to, number one, try and give some of the prisoners a job after they leave in the farming industry. And also, by having a farm there, they can cut their costs. They can actually grow vegetables, but not just vegetables, meat, which they can actually ship around the prisons in Western Australia. And of course, farms have animals. And the one thing about Carnot Prison Farm, they have their own slaughterhouse on site. They kill the animals there. And one of the jobs the prisoners have is working in the slaughterhouse, up to their knees in blood. And when I heard that, I thought, what a stupid idea, to breed violence amongst people who've already gone into jail for violent crimes. It never made sense to me. But this prisoner was telling me that those jobs in the slaughterhouse were some of the most sought after. And the most sought after job of all, he said you had to fight for that one, was the job of the slaughterer. Only the toughest prisoner could be the one who killed those animals. He looked me in the eye and said, "I am the slaughterer in this jail. I fought for this job. I am the one who kills the animals." But he went back and told me his background, how he'd come to prison, how he'd come to that job. He spoke with a very thick Irish accent. He'd come from Belfast. I think many of you know just what had happened in Belfast over the last 30 years. The Troubles, as they call it. And he told me to give me some background. Remember this story very clearly. He said, "Just to let you know how I was brought up, I was stabbed for the first time when I was 7 years of age. In the school playground," he said, "one of the tougher kids in the school came up to me and demanded the money I had for my lunch." He said, "I said no." The older boy drew out a long, sharp knife. "If you don't give me your money, I will stab you," he said. The Irishman talking to me said, "I thought he was bluffing." So I said no. He never asked us a third time. He just plunged the knife into my arm and drew it out slowly and walked away. He said, with blood streaming down my arm, in shock more than in pain, he ran out of the schoolyard. His father's house was just round the corner. He ran in, his father unemployed at home. "What's wrong?" "I've just been stabbed." His father took him into the kitchen straight away, but not to put anything on the wound. His father opened the drawer, took out another knife, gave it to his son, and ordered him to go back to school and stab the boy back. He said that's how he was brought up. That's why he'd been in many jails. You could see from the scars. He wasn't such a big man, he probably wouldn't have survived that long. Now he's in Carnot jail. He'd fought for the job of the slaughterer. He told me that what he did. In that slaughterhouse, there were strong stainless steel rails, wide at the entrance, which narrowed down to a passage such that one animal at a time could eventually walk through the passage. next to the passage on a platform was where he stood with an electric gun. He said the charge in that gun was strong enough to kill even the huge bulls. But he also said that no animal would ever stand still enough to aim properly. So he said his routine was one shot to stun, to keep the animal still enough. The second shot was when he would aim at the right place and kill the animal, whether it was pigs, sheep, cows, whatever. He'd been doing this for a long time, he said. Those animals had to be forced into that funnel with electric prods, or more usually dogs. They'd all be screaming, trying to escape. They're screaming in their own way. But he said what shook him was a couple of days ago, he said, they were killing cows. And this is where he started to swear. I won't say what he said, but it was very thick swearing because he started to get excited. And he said, it's God's own something truth. This actually happened, he said. It was confirmed later by the prisoners. This wasn't a lie. This actually happened. He said, they were killing cows. One shot to stun, second to kill. When a cow came into that passage like no cow he'd ever seen before. It had its head down, making no sound, making no effort to try and escape. It just walked, what as a Buddhist meditator would say mindfully, into place beneath his platform, willingly, quietly. And then when it was positioned itself voluntarily, knowing it was about to be slaughtered, it lifted its head, turned round at this Irish executioner and stared him in the eye. He said at this point he lost it. He'd never seen any animal behave like this, making no noise, not sort of agitated, not trying to escape. He said even though he had the opportunity to aim the gun in the right place and kill that animal with one shot, he just couldn't do it. The cow was looking right through him, had eye contact. He didn't know what was going on, because he'd never seen this ever before. Now you all know, you've all seen cows, how big the eye of a cow is. The cow was looking right into him, and he couldn't move his eyes away from the cow's eyes. He noticed something strange happening in the left eye of the cow. Water started to build up above the lower eyelid. He saw it grow and grow and grow until it was too much for the eyelid to hold back. He saw a trickle of water running down the left cheek of the cow. That threw him into timelessness, he told me. He didn't know how many minutes or hours or seconds. But then he saw the same happening in the other eye. Water growing and growing above the right eyelid, the lower eyelid of the right eye, until that water too was more than the eyelid could hold. And another trickle of tears was coming down the cheek of that cow. The cow was crying. That's where he completely changed. Long closed doors to his heart opened. He threw down the gun. He swore again. He said, that something cow ain't dying. You can do whatever you like to me. And when he came to see me, he said he's a vegetarian now. This was a very violent man who was converted by the tears of a cow. A cow that cried. Cows have emotions. They have feelings. They are not that much different than you or I. Each one of you have probably had animals as pets. When you get to know those animals, you get a feeling that these aren't that different than human beings. When you realize that, when you realize that animals do have emotions, they do have speech, they do have intelligence, they do have feelings, why on earth would you abuse them? Why would you go fishing and put that horrible hook in a fish's mouth? Sometimes Buddhists tell me, they say, oh, they go fishing for peace and quiet. So I tell them, okay then, if that's the reason, then you can go fishing. I advise them, go on, go fishing. But when you go fishing, make sure you don't put the hook on the end of your line. You can dangle the, because no one will know, no one will guess, because they can't see you've got nothing on the bottom there of your line. And then it's even more peaceful. You don't get disturbed by having all these fish sort of disturb you by pulling the line every now and again. So the Buddhist fishermen can always go there as long as they don't pull a hook. They just go there with a nice rod, dangle it in the water, and then it's so peaceful all afternoon. Of course, they don't catch anything, but I thought you were only going fishing for peace and quiet. So that's the answer to the Buddhist fishermen. Because sometimes people aren't honest. This is what I heard in Thailand. There aren't any Thais here, but you should be embarrassed about this. Because I asked the villagers, so you're supposed to be Buddhists. Why are you going catching fish and killing them? And they told me, oh, we don't kill the fish. We don't kill the fish. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. Talk about spin doctors. They were really great. But you do cause them misery. You do cause them death. So when you know that animals have feelings like that, then we don't want to abuse them anymore. We don't want to hurt them. We respect them. This amazing thing happens when you respect animals. How animals respect you. And so I was a forest monk. I lived in those jungles. You saw very, very dangerous animals. Especially those snakes. And I've told you here that not only... It's not that I've only just stepped on a snake. I peed on a snake once. I just got up early one morning and just went out to the forest to urinate. And I thought it was a stick. You know, early in the morning you're a bit sort of dozy. And it started wiggling. I was very, very lucky it didn't sort of bite me. Especially as you know what was most exposed at the time. I always say the snake probably thought it was holy water. It came from a mug. But the most important thing was that you felt so at ease with those animals. They're all dangerous because you really respected them. I don't mean respect to be afraid of them. You know, you were sharing their habitat. You respected them as beings. You spread loving kindness to them as beings. They're not as something separate from you to exploit and get rid of, especially if they abused you. They had their place and you welcomed them, hoping they would welcome you. And when you actually live like that with respect to animals, animals don't harm you. It's amazing just that. One of the biggest snakes I've seen in Australia, there was this 2.5-meter tiger snake. I know it was 2.5 meters. That's when I was doing my long six-month retreat. This huge thing came, and the kangaroos were feeding close by. They ran out of the way very quickly. It's this thing very, very huge, straight towards me, just as I was finishing my meal. And it lay straight out under the shade of my hut as I was washing my bowl, only a couple of feet away. And because it was stretched out, I could count it by the bricks. You know, I was a bricklayer, laid bricks before. One brick is, you know, 240 millimeters long with the mortar joint. And I counted it was 11 bricks, or 10 and a half bricks long. That's 2.5 meters. It's quite a long one. It's longer than you. And it was just looking at me. And I was looked at it, said hello, and carried on washing my bowl. When I next turned around, it could have struck me very easily, without any problem. When I looked around, it actually changed its direction. Its tail was pointing towards me, and its head was pointing completely the opposite direction. And it was amazing. What I knew was a gesture of fearlessness and respect. It was almost like it was guarding me. It felt no danger at all, as it put its most vulnerable point, its tail, straight in my direction. So many stories like that of animals being your friends because you're the friends of animals. You respect them and they respect you. You can live at peace and you can enjoy their company. Now, when you respect those animals, the last thing you'd ever do would be to abuse them, to exploit them. You actually share your space with them and you enjoy their company. This is actually why we find that animals have their place in this world. Just like human beings have their place in this world. I think I said a couple of weeks ago, looking at the forest, and every tree in that forest has its place. There are some trees which are falling over. There are some trees which are bent. There are some trees which are dead. But even the dead trees have their place. We don't cut down those dead trees, because those dead trees are the places where the birds nest. Every tree has its use in the forest. Every animal being has its place. Every person in this room has your place. You're all important. Sure, there are some trees which are taller than others. There are some trees which look beautiful. But that's not the point. Every tree is important in its own way, has its place, is welcome in the forest. Every person in this room is welcome here. There's no "I am better than the person sitting next to me." There's no best tree in the forest. Each got their value in different ways. Every animal has got its value. That's why we respect them. Learn to be at peace with them. Then the animals can help us. When we realize just how much we have in common. And also how much we can learn. How much we can be friends. How much we can share. That we'll stop this terrible speciesism of our planet. Where we think, no, animals don't have feelings. Therefore we can go and kill them, slaughter them. Have these terrible animal experiments. I was actually disgusted once, not once, many times, but this particular time I read in a newspaper about, I think, some American company were testing, they were testing American football helmets. You know these American people who play American football wear these protective helmets? They were testing these helmets by putting test models on chimpanzees and hurling these chimpanzees at a brick wall just to test which helmet sort of gave less brain damage. And what a stupid thing to do. Okay, maybe if there's for medical research, there's maybe an argument, but I don't agree with that argument myself, but just for football helmets, killing these monkeys again and again, I don't know how people can do that. I think they can only do that if it's like my granny, when they think somehow that, you know, they're not the same as us. They don't really feel. You know, they haven't got emotions. They don't feel pain. They're just like robots. But of course they're not. They feel. And it's their feelings. When you see animals suffer, they make you suffer as well. Have you ever seen one of those great ships going out of Fremantle, just packed with sheep? Don't know what you feel, but my heart always drops. The poor beings. Why do we do that to those animals? Packed so tight. On the way up here every now and again, you pass these sheep trucks. And these sheep they're packed so tightly, can hardly move. Sometimes their legs get trapped between the small slits and you see it. And anyone with any compassion would feel so terrible. Why are we doing that to people? The sheep are people. They're beings the same as us. Why are we hurting animals, beings like that, causing them so much pain and suffering? Can we not lessen that? Unfortunately, in this life, we can't abolish it completely. In the same way that we cannot abolish human suffering. But at least out of compassion, we should try and limit it. Lessen needless suffering with our animals. Because animals are beings. When you respect those animals, then you have, for example, this common question which Buddhists ask me. Sometimes they have an animal, like a pet dog or a cat, and it gets very sick. Should you take it to the vet? Or should you not take it to the vet? Remember sort of Jasper, I've already mentioned him, telling me about this person who took their Labrador to the vet. And the vet actually, oh, he had a bad eye, something wrong with its eye. And the vet picked it up, so looked underneath it, looked at its back and its head, and told the owner, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put it down. What do you mean, put it down? It's only got a bad eye. And the vet said, I've got to put it down, because it's heavy. That was a joke. But sometimes you do have an animal with a problem. What do you do? And a lot of times, my answer is actually ask the animal. Ask your cat or your dog whether it's had enough, whether it wants to go to the vet and be killed. Be honest with it. You know, you're going to give it euthanasia. Just like Dr. It's euthanasia by taking it to the vet. And sometimes you can ask that dog or that cat and the dog wants to go. It has had enough. By asking it, I mean, if you're the owner of an animal, or well, not the owner, but a friend, you should really say it properly, a partner, sharing the same house together, it doesn't take that much to actually to feel what the animal wants. And that's what I'd always advise. Ask the animal. If it's a cat or a dog, make the question and feel what the answer is. And if you're at all sensitive to the animal who shares your house, you will probably know straight away. You've lived with that animal for so long. You are partners. You know each other. You can feel what the animal wants. And sometimes you look at that animal and you know it's had enough. It wants to go to the vet. You know it wants to end its suffering, but it's ending its suffering. People these days say we put the animal out of its suffering. They don't. They put it out of your own suffering because people don't like. They're afraid of seeing another person suffer. It reminds us of our own suffering. But you ask that animal, sometimes it'll say, no, I don't want to. I'd rather be like this for a bit longer. Let your animal decide. Respect that animal. You know, most kangaroos, which I've seen, they don't want to go to the vet. They don't want to be shot. Even when they're hit by a car, and sometimes we see the animals hit by a car on the side of the road, they just want to crawl under a bush and see what happens, to die in their own way. That's why a couple of times that's happened, I think, recently, one of our Anagarikas hit a kangaroo. Even though we try and go as slow as possible on that road, sometimes they just jump out from nowhere. I knew where it was. And asked me, should we call the vet? Or the ranger, rather. And we talked about it. We knew exactly what would happen. The ranger would just come and shoot that kangaroo straight away. I think I know I'm sensitive enough to know those kangaroos. They don't want to be shot. They want to die in their own way. Would you like to be shot if you're in hospital? If someone came along with a gun to bed, if you had enough, do you want to be shot? You'll certainly free up lots of beds, I suppose, but maybe we should, you know, there's a health crisis and not enough beds, maybe we should suggest that to our local state government. Of course, it's a stupid suggestion. So why do we do that to animals? I let the animal decide. And this is actually respect and sensitivity to our animals. And when we have these terrible things like that bird flu, and just killed so many animals, and all we needed was a few injections. When you get a flu, do you get killed? When we have a flu going through sort of Perth, do we get all the people who've got flu and put them all together and kill them all and bury them in one big mound just to make sure that the flu epidemic doesn't go further and doesn't go to Adelaide or Sydney? Now, there's one rule for animals, there's another room for human beings. And I think Buddhism is saying, no, the same rules should apply to both. The only reason they killed so many birds was economics, for the old dollar, for money. And I think our society shouldn't just go according to money. Surely we should have things like compassion, the quality of life, rather than the amount of power we have. So as a Buddhist, we've always, from the very beginning, had this respect for animals. There's a whole list of stories called Jataka tales. Before Walt Disney started anthropomorphizing sort of animals with Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, the Buddha was doing that 2,500 years before Walt Disney even thought of it, with the Jataka tales of animal stories, beautiful animal stories, animals who could speak, animals who had compassion, animals who would sometimes sacrifice their life for somebody else. And they're very beautiful stories to read because they touch our heart. They make every being who exists have a place, have respect. So we overcome that speciesism with respect for our world. That's part of ecology. That's part of being sensitive to our environment. Even actually recently someone came to our monastery and said, what about like the feral animals? What should we do with those? Because they're destroying so many other of the beings. Should we actually catch and kill those? And sometimes, I remember as a monk seeing these little worms would come out of the ground when the first rains come, and these black ants would attack them. Sometimes we'd be walking through the forest, and the black ants would think your toe was a big fat worm and start attacking it. And just one ant, they would sting you. It was like a bull ant. They were called motlin. And they would make you jump. They stung so much. And you saw this little worm with maybe 10 or 20. And the first time you saw this, you try and save the worm, because you knew how much it must hurt. And sort of, you know, get all the little ants off it and release it. But then, was that being compassionate to the ants? Taking away their dinner? And after a while, you realize that respect for nature is actually leaving it alone, not trying to control it, not exploiting it, but respecting it. And so I was actually saying to this lady, those feral animals, if we really want to destroy the feral animals who actually creating so much problem in our natural environment, we should start with killing us. We're the worst of the feral animals who've come to Australia. Human beings. Now, no one would think of actually putting poison out for all the people who actually visit the state forests. But isn't that what we're doing with the cats, with the rabbits, with everything else? Somehow, this is a change which always happens. The change of the environment. As you know, certain trees move south, some other flora moves north, animals come and animals go. This is part of the whole. We respect nature. We respect life. We respect species. We become at peace with sort of nature, the way that life is. Instead of always trying to be these great controllers, exploiters, abusers, we become these people with more respect and gratitude. In the same way that you respect and are grateful for the people you live with, for your husband, your wife, you don't want to call the pest controller in to exterminate your husband. I'm sure that if you had sort of not just termite exterminators, but husband exterminators, I'm sure they do great business in Perth. But it's against the law, thank goodness. But it's not just against the law, but it's against the idea of like learning to live with things rather than learning to just exterminate things which we don't agree with or we don't sort of find harmful or difficult to bear. So in the same way, even the feral animals, we respect them too. Allow them to be. Stop controlling. nature will find its way. We had this problem with the monastery in Chithurst some years ago. This is the monastery, which our sister monastery in Sussex. They had all these rabbits living in the grounds, which was fine, nice. You know, rabbits are quite cute little animals. But the problem was, they would actually stay in the monastery all day, and at night time they'd go into the neighbour's fields, eat all their crops, and come back to the monastery for sanctuary. They're very clever. And of course, all the neighbours, they said, well, we know you're Buddhists and all that, but look, you've got to be reasonable. This is our livelihood. You know, they're eating all of our crops. You've got to exterminate them. So the monks actually thought about it. It's true, we can't just be compassionate to the rabbits and not be compassionate to our neighbours. They count too. But they did some lateral thinking. We don't need to exterminate them. Let's put a rabbit fence around the monastery to keep the rabbits in. So they went to a huge amount of expense, because the rabbit fence, you've got to actually dig it into the ground about, I don't know, a metre or something, because otherwise the rabbits would actually tunnel underneath it. So they went to this huge expense to put a rabbit fence around the monastery to keep the rabbits in. So the rabbits were happy, the farmers were happy, and the monks were happy. What a wonderful solution. But the farmers thought, you're crazy. Those rabbits will just keep on growing and growing until they just swarm all over the monastery. But that never happened. Maybe it's because the rabbits took the example from the monks and kept the 8 precepts. Well, I don't know what it was. But certainly, they actually got their right population, they stayed at that population, they never increased above that. I don't know how they do it, but nature knows how to balance. So we don't need to control to exploit, because controlling and exploiting, that's what abuse really means. As Buddhists, we respect all living beings. May all living beings be happy and well. We don't need to control them or abuse them. In the same way, we don't control or abuse the people we live with. We don't control or abuse the people we work with. We don't control or abuse ourselves. We have loving kindness, peace, acceptance, freedom from desire to ourselves, to the animals. That same attitude goes to our meditation, goes to the beings we share this planet with, goes to the thoughts which share our mind. Goes to all beings, sentient beings and immaterial beings. Goes to the heat and cold of the world. We learn to live with these things, to be with them, to appreciate them. We never become exterminators. And that's actually the Buddhist attitude to sort of animal abuse. Had no part in early Buddhism, still has no part. Not only animal abuse, human abuse, child abuse, wife abuse, husband abuse, and certainly what we're really against is monk abuse. And if I go on talking any longer, you'll be abusing me. So thank you for listening to this evening's talk. Has anyone got any questions or comments on this evening's talk? Any questions? There's one at the back, yeah. That's really a great story. Did you all hear that? Now, okay, she was saying she's got a big black cat in her house, and one day she brought one of these toy mouse, like which you wind up and runs along the floor, for her cat. And when she first brought it, she actually wound it up, put it in front of her cat, and the cat just looked at her as if she was stupid, and just calmly walked out of the house, and came back in 3 minutes later with a live mouse and just dropped it at the floor. And the mouse was still alive? The mouse was still alive and just looked at the owner saying, you know, would you take me to be a fool or something? It's a great story. It's a really smart cat. The animals know what's going on. I don't think it's you put one over on your cat or your dog. That's very nice story. Thank you for that one. Not just animals, not just like cats and dogs, but other animals, they know what's happening. And if you're really kind to them, they know what's going on. Okay, I think that's probably enough for now. So, we now have President, would you want to...